طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. The massacre at Standing Rock continues and escalates, and President Obama, true to form, does nothing, just as he has done nothing positive in 8 years on the Palestinian issue, which we will examine in more detail in a minute. But first, I want to read excerpts from Nadia Aliyah's incisive article in Mondawais, where once again a Palestinian journalist sees the parallel struggles of Native Americans and Palestinians. She writes, "One of the accusations most frequently lobbed at BDS activists, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, is that boycotts are divisive. Apparently, they drive a wedge in society, pitting community members against each other. Our response has consistently been that the division is already there between those who support justice and equal rights for all and the Zionists who advocate ethno-religious supremacy and the disenfranchisement of the Palestinian people. And since our country, our government, our tax dollars support Zionism, we are inevitably involved in the oppression. In other words, there is no default position of neutrality, which BDS threatens. The polarity already exists. It is only being brought into prominence by boycotts, which allow people to act upon their conscience. By default, meaning by not engaging in BDS, we are siding with the oppressor, whereas the targeted boycott of Israeli products and of companies that benefit from Israelis' violation of the human rights of the Palestinian people allows us to switch sides so as to be on the side of justice. Today, as the U.S. is fast becoming more openly polarized around various political developments not directly related to Palestinian justice, we are seeing a number of calls for boycotts and divestment, and a national embrace of boycotts by both conservative and progressive groups. Again, boycotts are not polarizing the people engaging in them. Rather, these are groups and individuals with strong opinions about certain issues who find boycotts to be a useful tool in their rejection of what they consider unethical, unjust, unacceptable. Thus, we see that the water protectors, the opponents of the North Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL, are calling for divestment from banks that fund the pipeline. And people around the nation are withdrawing their money from these banks and placing them in credit unions or smaller banks not involved in financing the pipeline. The divestment itself is not viewed as divisive. Rather, it is an action of people who understand that their money would otherwise support the side they oppose on an issue they feel very strongly about. The struggle between the pipeline and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation would exist anyway. It is not the call for taking out one's money from certain banks that somehow caused the confrontation. That call clearly articulates the impetus behind the calls for divestment put out by BDS activists for justice in Palestine. The community is sending a message to companies that we do not approve of the projects in which they invest our money. Progressives are definitely not the only group calling for boycotts. Various conservative groups, including the American Family Association and the Concerned Women of America, have called for a boycott of Target stores over their LGBTQ-friendly policy, which welcomes transgender team members and guests to use the restroom or fitting room facility that corresponds with their gender identity. Concerned Women of America wrote, "At Concerned Women for America, we know we can't just vote with a ballot. We must vote with our wallets. Our hope is that Target will hear our vote clear and loud this holiday season." And to give just one more recent example, Trump supporters are calling for a boycott of the Broadway show Hamilton after its cast read a statement to Mike Pence, Trump's elected vice president, following a performance he attended. Apparently, 'tis the season to boycott. At the same time, there is a flurry of legislation in many U.S. states against boycotts, sponsored by Zionists seeking to delegitimize BDS. The legislation has already been challenged and defeated as anti-constitutional in a few states, notably Maryland and Virginia. But bills are still being proposed, which will be discussed and voted on when the legislative sessions open again in January. To challenge such lawfare, legal allies such as Palestine Legal, the National Lawyers Guild, and the Center for Constitutional Rights are arguing that boycotts qualify as our First Amendment right to freedom of expression. A very helpful article in the Harvard Law Review points out that the Supreme Court has long held that boycotts to bring about political, economic, and social change, like boycotts for Palestinian rights, are a form of expression protected by the First Amendment. This was established when the Supreme Court reviewed the case of the NAACP boycott of white-owned businesses to pressure city officials to meet demands for racial equality and integration. The court recognized that political boycotts involve a range of expressive activity and rely on the First Amendment freedoms of speech, assembly, association, and petition. Thus, when a bill advocates legal repercussions for engaging in boycotts, that bill is infringing on citizens' First Amendment rights. Indeed, our rights are coming under attack from various angles. As Garrett Epps, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore, noted in the morning after the 2016 presidential elections, there is hardly a provision of the Bill of Rights or later amendments Trump did not explicitly promise to override, from First Amendment freedom of the press and religion to Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable search and seizures to Sixth Amendment right to counsel to 14th Amendment birthright citizenship and equal protection and 15th Amendment voting rights. Rather than being divisive then, will boycotts become the grassroots movement that unifies this country as our constitutional rights come under further attack? As more people vote with their wallets and grow to better appreciate the accessibility, but also the legality of boycotts, we need to understand that now is the time to deal a blow to challenges against this strategy. Boycotts are legal. They are protected by our First Amendment right to free speech and freedom of expression, and they can be targeted at department stores with liberal policies, as well as at companies that profit from the violation of human rights and the desecration of indigenous lands from Standing Rock to Palestine. We cannot allow Zionists, be they Democrats or Republicans, to abrogate our constitutional rights so as to further shield Israel from accountability. That was an excerpt from an article in Mondawise, written by Nadia Alia. And now on to our feature presentation. This morning we take a long look at the Obama legacy concerning the Palestinian-Israeli struggle from the point of view of Palestinian-Canadian attorney Diana Boutu. The following is a speech she gave at Tufts University on November 16th. It is moderated by Tufts professor Tom Aboud.
Diana Boutu is a Palestinian lawyer and analyst, and among a handful of people in the international community who know just about who are the top echelon of legal minds and scholars and analysts on the question of Palestine and Israel-Palestine. And tonight she's going to be talking about the legacy of the Obama administration and maybe new legacies to come, but properly historicized within the, I think, the recent political history of the Bush administration and that and those sets of legacies. Diana served on the Palestinian negotiating team, the Palestinian government's negotiating team from 2000 to 2005. She was the only woman involved in the negotiations, and she later worked in Mahmoud Abbas's office. She now works as an independent lawyer and is a policy advisor and to a Palestinian think tank by the name of
Shabaka.
Thank you. Wanted to get that right. What we'll do is, as I said before, we'll have plenty of time for question and answer, but for just this moment, please help me in welcoming our esteemed guest, Diana Boutu.
Thank you very much. First, thank you very much, Tom, for the invitation, and thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to see so many friendly faces again. The last time I spoke in this very hall was, I think, 2010. 2011, so it's been quite some time, and it's wonderful to be back. So, you know, now that the election results are in, I was hoping to hear a collective groan. maybe this really isn't Massachusetts. Anyway, I think it's time for us to really step back and look at what it is that President-elect Trump is going to be coming into office with, and what the legacy of President Obama is and will go down as. And when I was thinking about what Obama's legacy is going to be on this issue, I think it's important for us to first put to keep in mind what it is that President Obama inherited on when he not only on the eve of his election, but after he came to office. And there are a number of things that we have to keep in mind. The first is that Obama came into office the tail end of the 2008-2009 attack on Gaza, an attack in which the Israelis began to use some unprecedented levels of weaponry and force on Palestinians, in which half of the people who were killed were children under the age of 18 and women. And President Obama had chose during that period of time, because this was the tail end of 2008 and up until 2009, not to speak to the issue of the attack on Gaza, because he said that only one president speaks at a time, and that it wasn't really his position to do any speaking. Now, of course, he did speak on a whole bunch of other issues that were pressing during that period of time, but he remained silent on the issue of Gaza, and I'll explain why that becomes important very shortly. The second thing that President Obama inherited was something that obviously predates him, which was the Hamas-Fatah split. The Hamas-Fatah split being the ousting of Fatah from the Gaza Strip, the split between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the continued split between those two. And the third thing that he inherited was something to come along not too far after he was elected, which is Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, why is that important? Prime Minister Netanyahu is the prime minister who has, A, served as the longest prime minister in Israel's history, and B, he will go down as being one of the most racist prime ministers in Israel's history, with everything from promoting settlement activity to talking about Palestinians voting in droves. And then ramping up demolitions and so on. And the fourth thing that Obama inherited was, again, not too long after he became president, was the Goldstone Report, a report in which Israel was rebuked for its actions in the Gaza Strip, the 2008-2009 actions. And then lastly, and one of the most important, is that he inherited the exchange of letters between the Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, who was there, still alive at the time, and the U.S. President Bush. And this letter was a letter in which, for the first time in U.S. history, there was a movement away from condemning all of Israel's settlements to a view that Israel's settlements would now need to be accommodated. Now, why are all of these elements so significant? The elements are so significant, each one of these elements is so significant, because on the eve of when President Obama came into office, there were some actions that he undertook that indicated that he was going to somehow change course and undo the policies that had been done under the Bush years. And some of those actions were, first, if that's something you may or may not recall, the very first phone call that he made as president was to Mahmoud Abbas. The reason that was significant was when President Obama was inaugurated, by that point in time, Mahmoud Abbas's term had actually expired. It had come to an end. He was elected in 2005. His term expired in 2009. And when Obama came into office, what he was signaling to the Palestinians was that, A, I'm going to be dealing with this issue, and B, I still recognize that Mahmoud Abbas is your elected president, even though his term had expired. And that becomes significant because it sets into motion all of the other elements that continue to be at play to today. The second thing that President Obama did was, very quickly on, he appointed Senator George Mitchell to come in into Palestine and to serve as sort of a mediator. And the reason that this was significant was that if you think of where President Bush had taken the bilateral process of negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it was completely torn apart. We were following something called the roadmap. Even that was now in tatters. And instead, it looked as though, with the appointment of Senator Mitchell, that he was going to take a path of not pressing for bilateral negotiations as had been done in the past, but instead look to conflict resolution rather than conflict management, something that the Bush administration had been focusing on. The third thing that he had done was that, if you recall, this is all early on in his presidency, when the Israelis announced their first set of new expansions of settlements in East Jerusalem, President Obama's administration, he didn't do it himself, came out condemning the settlements and the settlement expansion. So here you have, in a period of 2009, within a few short months, a 1-2-3. He's called Mahmoud Abbas and said, I still recognize you as president. He's done number two, which is to appoint Senator Mitchell and indicate that he wants to actually go down the path of conflict resolution rather than management. And number three is he's come out in condemnation, or his administration has, in condemnation of Israel's settlements, and in particular the settlements in East Jerusalem, which is perhaps the most important, given that this country has shifted its policies when it comes to East Jerusalem. But that didn't last long. And very quickly, when faced with a little bit of opposition by Prime Minister Netanyahu, Obama begins to reverse course. And he begins to reverse course by, A, ignoring ongoing settlement activity, B, ignoring the ongoing demolitions that the Israelis are undertaking, and C, remaining silent on all of Israel's actions. So looking up to it up at that point in time, you can easily say, well, he's become just like every other U.S. president that we've had up until that time. Here's a president who takes a hands-off approach, facing a little bit of opposition, doesn't want to upset the cart, as the expression goes. He's somebody who's going to delay this to a further point in time until he has the ability to perhaps be in a second term. And as somebody who's lived through second term, so I feel like I've lived through this pure process of new president, euphoria, then there's a settling in that this new president can't do anything. Second term, euphoria, because the second term president can do something. Second term, elections happen, euphoria, because now the new president can do something. Late second term, euphoria, because now it's, what did you guys call it, the lame duck? Is that
lame duck.
All right. And so I've lived through 16 years of euphoria, and the situation is obviously only getting worse. But what is it that Obama, so looking up into that first period, it's easy to look back and say, he's just like every other president, you have to wait for the next term, for the euphoria to kick in, and then you can begin to analyze President Obama's actions a little bit more critically, there's no need to be so harsh on him, etc. But yet, you have to now look at not only the second term, but also that first term. And there are some things that, it wasn't just a question of Obama just being like every other president and allowing things to continue along the same path, moving away from conflict resolution to conflict management as President Bush did. But here's where the detrimental things begin to kick in with President Obama. And the first is that the language when it comes to Israeli settlements has completely changed. Completely changed. From whether you look at Carter, even before Carter administration onward, you see a watering down of the U.S. position when it comes to Israel's settlements. From being illegal to later being an obstacle to peace, to later being, not helpful, then being a violation of roadmap obligations that was under President Bush, to now being, not even that, now it's continued settlement activity is not legitimate. Continued settlement activity is not legitimate. Paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. What does continued settlement activity not legitimate means? It means that all of the other settlement activity that has taken place during that period of time is legitimate. It's simply the continued settlement activity that's not even illegal. It's just not legitimate. So in other words, moving away from this idea that there is law that governs the relationship between occupier and occupied, law that governs the relationship of whether you can steal land or not steal land, international law that's in place that affects each and every country, including this country, around the world. Instead, he's parsed it away so that what he's done is that his continued settlement activity is not legitimate. And so the question becomes, when does the continued begin? And if you look at the record of President Obama's period from 2008 until the current day, just before the current day, about 2015, not including 2016, you see that in this 8-year stretch, actually 7-year stretch, that the number of settlers has actually increased in the West Bank by well over 150,000. These are by Israeli statistics, not Palestinian statistics, which places it even higher. By official Israeli statistics, the number has increased by over 150,000. And so again, the question becomes, when does that continued part kick in? Does it kick in at 2008, when Obama assumes office? Does it kick, or when he's elected, does it kick in 2009 when he assumes office? Does it kick in at a later stage? When does that continued part kick in? Continued settlement activity is illegitimate. The second thing that Obama does that's detrimental, again, this isn't just a question of conflict, you know, management. We're just going to wait and kick the can to the next president. He begins to cement the siege on the Gaza Strip. The siege, to be clear, begins before him, predates him. It begins under President Bush. But what Obama does is he cements and allows to cement the continued siege on the Gaza Strip. And the idea that Israel is allowed to continue to blockade Gaza, even after the bombing campaigns, I'll get to that in just a second, President Obama, after they make the U.S. makes pledges that they're going to rebuild Gaza, he continues to allow the siege to remain in place on the Gaza Strip, a siege which the U.S. knows full well has made Gaza unlivable, a siege where the U.S. knows full well that 95% of the water supply is not fit for human consumption, a siege that they know very well is affecting disproportionately children under the age of 18. It's affected practically every aspect of life, whether it's education, health, your ability to travel, your ability to see your friends, your ability to have a normal life has been impacted by this siege. And the next thing that President Obama does is he allows Israel to turn international law on its head. Not only when it comes to the settlements, but also when it comes to the bombing of Gaza. Now, under international law, there are certain places that you can't bomb, which is what I was talking about earlier with Goldstone, like mosques, schools, health facilities, etc. I mean, you don't need to have a law degree to realize that these things are things that shouldn't be bombed. And yet, what Obama does is he actually allows this to happen. He doesn't step back or push back on Israel when it undertakes two bombing campaigns during his presidency. There was one that predates him, as I was mentioning, but two bombing campaigns during his presidency. He doesn't push back on it, but instead continues to toe the line that an occupied people have to provide security to their occupier. And he continues to push forward and refuses to condemn Israel's bombing of hospitals, schools, etc., medical facilities, etc. In addition, the one-two of having the siege imposed on Gaza and the bombing campaign that Israel undertakes, these two bombing campaigns during his presidency, has now meant that there are about 100,000 structures that remain in some form of disrepair in Gaza, bombed or completely bombed or in need of very serious repair, without the ability to be able to repair any of those buildings. Now, even before these two bombing campaigns, the UN came out and said that by the year 2020, the Gaza Strip would become unlivable. And now with these two bombing campaigns, with over 100,000 buildings that still remain in a state of disrepair, the inability to repair the water supply, an electricity supply that is at best providing 4 hours of electricity to the Gaza Strip, the inability to import gasoline, much needed gasoline and fuel supplies into the Gaza Strip to be able to operate and to be able to live with electricity. These are all things that have been allowed and permitted under the Obama administration. Coupled with that, the Israelis in 2010, in May of 2010, undertake an attack on a flotilla in Gaza. And again, no word of condemnation from President Obama. All of this to say that all of these actions are actions that he simply allows to take place and sets the course for future events. Today in Israel, it's now considered, when Peres died, by the way, there were a lot of people who were talking about Peres' death and how detrimental Menapes, all this sort of stuff. One of the things that Peres did was Peres set into motion the idea that it's okay to bomb UN buildings. He did this in Khan in 1996. What Obama does is he further cements the idea that it's okay for Israel to bomb UN buildings during the two attacks, 2012 and 2014. The next thing that Obama does is we are now in Palestine witnessing the highest rate of demolitions under any U.S. presidency. The highest rate of demolitions under any U.S. presidency. 2016 alone is almost triple the number of structures that were demolished in 2015. Just by the end of October of this year, 989 structures were demolished. Israelis demolished 989 structures, including 122 in East Jerusalem alone. Nearly triple the number of demolitions in 2015. The period of 2008 until 2016, these eight-year period of Obama, is the highest rate of home demolitions that we've ever witnessed in Palestine. In fact, higher than the two decades that preceded. Okay. And lastly, what Obama has done, and this perhaps is the most detrimental, is that he is the president, he's the only president since 1967, not to undertake any action, not to condemn any of Israel's actions in the Security Council. Mm-hmm. He's the first U.S. president not to condemn any of Israel's actions in the U.N. Security Council. So this isn't just a question of, you know, all of them, including Biden, including President Bush, both of them, condemned Israel's actions. He's the first U.S. president to do absolutely nothing. And so what does this sum total leave for us? The sum total leaves for us not a presidency, a president who has just decided he's just going to kick the can to the next president. Far be it. He's actually set into place a course of action that has legitimated Israel's ongoing theft of Palestinian land, displacement of Palestinians through the home demolitions, the legalization of the theft of Palestinian land through the settlement construction, the idea that it's okay to bomb places like Gaza, that it's okay to withhold electricity, that it's okay to have a faulty water supply. He's legitimated and allowed a continuing expulsion of Palestinians through the evictions from settlers. So all of this to say, this is not a president who is just simply kicking the can until the next one. And so where does this leave us now that we have President Trump? Can't believe I'm saying that, but anyway, President Trump. You know, this is where I get a lot of, I've been asked this a lot lately, of isn't this, you know, he's got to be better, he's going to be different, he's going to be, you know, whatever. He's going to be worse. Why? First, he's already inheriting a system that is so bad that even if he does nothing, which I don't think Trump is going to do nothing, he's left a legacy that we will look back on this administration and say this was the turning point. The second thing that I think Trump is going to do is, you know, I live in Haifa, which is in Israel, and when you live there, it's commonplace to hear racist stuff, like just really racist stuff. And sometimes I call people out on it, sometimes you just, like, where am I living? And the racism in Israel has now reached new heights, to the point where all of the public opinion polls are saying that even younger generations don't want to live in the same building as Palestinians, that they don't want to see Arabs. They want to get them out of their country. The number of people who are voting for the right wing and this isn't like a benign right wing, this is an extreme right wing, is on the rise. And you can say things like, oh, well, they're not voting in terms of Palestinian issues, but they're also not voting in terms of Palestinian issues. So just in the same way that you can say not all Trump supporters are racist, all Trump supporters decided, took a decision at one point in time that they were going to excuse the racism. And same with the case, say, so is the case when it comes to the Israelis. With Trump in office now, that racism that exists in Israel that may have had a little bit of a break on it because of President Obama and the U.S. administration is now going to go full tilt, full speed ahead. There is no holding back that level of racism. Already there are attempts to legalize the settlements. There are some bills that the Knesset is trying to pass to legalize the theft of private Palestinian land for settlements. I think that Trump's going to look the other way, not pay attention to that. And then other talk is that he will obviously move the embassy. Moving the embassy isn't as huge of importance other than the idea that it creates this notion that that Israel gets to be rewarded for its settlement activity. And so all of this is to say, and that's the mild version of Trump. That's the mild version. This is the version of Trump that if he decides he's not really going to do a whole lot. That's the mild version of Trump. So to close up, and I'm going to close quickly now, is to say that I know it's very easy to look at Trump and to say we're in for a really rough 4, potentially 8 years. But I think that we also shouldn't gloss over the 8 very brutal years the Palestinians have lived under an Obama presidency. A presidency in which we were told and promised that he was going to put this on the forefront of his agenda. A presidency in which he made clear that he didn't want to see continuing settlement activity. A presidency in which he made clear that he wanted to see this resolved. So I think, just to end up, is we need to really, if there are a few months left in the Obama term, there is some talk of the U.S. putting into place, not vetoing a resolution on settlements. There is some talk of the U.S. not vetoing a resolution on parameters, etc. I think that at this point in time, the damage has been done.
Thank you, Deanna, so much. That was wonderful. So why don't we just very informally... are there questions or comments anyone would like to make? Yes.
Please try to tell us what caused the shift in Obama's approach. Why? Why has he taken this stand that he did, which is, which you described very, very fully in your talk?
It's hard to say, because I think there are a number of different events that may have led to the shift. I think the first shift was that at a certain point he decided that the political calculation, and I forgot to mention, by the way, the $38 billion package is going to Israel. Yeah. No thank you to you, but anyway. no thank you, America. So I think that part of it was that he made a political calculation. This was something that simply wasn't worth it any longer, that he was facing significant pushback. I think the other thing is that he miscalculated where Israeli public opinion actually was. Mm-hmm. And he was willing to push if he had seen that there was an Israeli public that was also willing to push back, to go alongside with him. And he didn't see that. In fact, he didn't get that message at all. By the time he made his Cairo speech in 2009, it was already clear that Israel had already shifted to the right. Like, Netanyahu's victory wasn't a little blip on the calendar. It was a reflection of political opinion in the country. And so I think that for him, the idea that he's going to have to risk something, place some political capital in that. And again, this is his first term. And there isn't an Israeli public that's backing him, was something that made him take a backseat. But then that doesn't really explain the second term stuff. And by the second term, I think at that point he just decided that he was over with it. Now, I've heard other analyses as well. I've heard people who were in the know, who were in the White House and otherwise, who said that part of the problem was that this Hamas-Fatah split, he didn't really want to go down the path of supporting Mahmoud Abbas, because Mahmoud Abbas wouldn't be able to deliver. I've heard that many times. I've heard other people say that if Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas weren't ready to reconcile, he wasn't going to go down that path. That strikes me as a little bit false, because you don't need Mahmoud Abbas to stop an attack on Gaza. Right? You don't need Mahmoud Abbas to stop an attack on the flotilla. You don't need Mahmoud Abbas to be facilitating the fuel into Gaza, or the repair of the electricity supply or the water supply. I mean, he doesn't, or to condemn settlements. He doesn't need any of that. So the second term answer is, I actually don't know. I think he just decided that was not a political calculation he was going to make.
Yeah, but well, to follow on from that, you haven't mentioned the Iran deal and what
right.
effect that had on his policy.
I don't think it did, to be quite honest. I think that Iran was Iran, and that there's a lot of speculation that Iran would then free up Obama to then address Israel, or that because there was the Iran deal that he was going to take a hands-off approach to Israel. I actually don't think that any of that really had anything to do with it. In fact, if anything, the Iran deal should have pushed Obama further to be challenging Israel, because, as you remember, it was Israel that was tried to block this Iran deal, and thankfully they were not successful in that. But yeah, it's hard to say. It really is hard. I mean, I'm not in his mind. And so what I'm told now is that there is some talk of having a Security Council resolution, that nobody's in his mind except for him. He hasn't really revealed anything. Who knows? But I can tell you, up until now, this is his legacy. And even if there's a resolution that comes out at this late hour condemning settlements or parameters resolution or anything like that, the damage has been done. The damage has been done for generations.
So are we moving from a labor-like government in this country to a Likud-like administration?
Moving? So you don't think it's been Likud already? on this particular issue, you think like it's moving? The only thing that I think that the big shift and like the most detrimental turning point in Palestinian history, modern Palestinian history, was the negotiations process. Clinton. I think that when he took the path of going down this bilateral negotiations process, it set into motion a whole spectrum that is very difficult to undo, whether it's the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, and through that the security regime, where 40% of the budget goes towards security rather than to anything else, double the amount that goes to education and health combined. Whether it's the idea that there has to be bilateral negotiation, I think all of that began under Clinton. And the ability to turn back from that could have been done under the Bush administration, but he was an ideologue and chose not to. The problem with Obama is that Obama had the ability to do much more and chose not to. So is this the Likud version of America? I think the Likud version of America came into place with Clinton. And I think that has only just been a question of shades ever since.
Sometimes I'm interested in the sort of legal perspective and how in Israel's disregard for international law, and if there's anything that can be done to sort of enforce it in a different way that's not reliant on sort of U.S. power taking the lead on that, if there are any other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the biggest problem with international law is that it's international law, is that there's no way of enforcing it. International law is, it consists of state practice and state enforcement. And insofar as you have state practice can actually change international law and develop international law. And that's why I'm so worried about, as I was talking about the idea that it's only focusing on continued settlement activity. Mm-hmm. My fear is that, so under international law, all of the settlements are illegal. There is no scope for legality of the settlements. The world has recognized the annexation of East Jerusalem as illegal. All the settlements are illegal. The problem is that we're going down this path where you have a country that's trying to change international law, which is Israel, and another country that's bolstering that change, being the United States. And so my fear as an international lawyer is that the more that state practice changes, the more that what we define international law to be also changes. Mm-hmm. So just in the same way that if you look at domestic criminal law, why is it that white, quote-unquote, white-collar crimes are considered, get less penalty than other crimes, is because there's a significant amount of pressure that is exerted on the criminal system to make sure that white-collar crimes don't get punished receive lighter sentences. So too in the international system, you can't ignore the element of power that's in play. And that's why I was saying I'm so afraid of this shift in international law. Now, can it be enforced? Yes, but it requires a number of different things. First, it requires the Palestinians to go to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And the ICC is itself a very politicized body. Although the Palestinians have signed on to the International Criminal Court, they haven't yet brought a case before the International Criminal Court. And even if they were, it's not to say that the prosecutor would really take it and run with it. It's become so politicized that even where they've opened up investigations, there have been some investigations that have gone on for now 9 years in Afghanistan. I mean, how long does it take to investigate? So it could go down that path, but it might be blocked by the prosecutor. That's assuming that the Palestinians can take it down that path. Other mechanisms is you can take it to the International Court of Justice. You can try, which was done in the past with the wall. And successful, but no action on it. You can try to get international law enforced domestically, whether it's in the United States or in other countries, Canada, Europe, etc. All those mechanisms are available, but they are long-term mechanisms, not short-term mechanisms, which is why the diplomatic front is so important. That being said, I think it's important that we as Palestinians begin to pursue those legal options. Because if we don't, then we are going to see the watering down of language when it comes to settlements. We've already seen it. Even with this U.S. position now, although the Europeans have still held firm to their position on settlements, that doesn't mean they're going to hold firm in 5 years' time. And already in place with the way that they've begun to recognize the settlements in East Jerusalem, it's already happened. So there are mechanisms, and we should be taking advantage of those mechanisms. Sadly, we don't have a leadership that's doing
it. A point of clarification, did you say the Europeans' position on East Jerusalem settlements is gradually, you're seeing it shift?
They keep saying that it hasn't shifted, but I can tell you, one of the things that they love to see is they love to see Palestinians going to Israeli courts to try to seek redress for their rights in Israeli courts. And this is a court system that has proven to be not just a failure, it's designed to be a failure for Palestinians. And so the Europeans want to see Palestinians continuing to legitimate a system that shouldn't have any legitimacy whatsoever.
You have been listening to a presentation by Canadian-Palestinian attorney Diana Buttu, who now lives in Haifa. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can find all our past programs on our archive. go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. You will find all our past programs. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.